I do. Welcome, everybody, to our IONS meeting by Zoom. We appreciate your joining us tonight. I'm Martin Tanner, the chair of Utah IONS. I'm a member of the board along with eight others. Craig Miller will be co-hosting this evening. We'd like to welcome everyone to our Zoom version, one of our many Zoom versions of IONS Utah's monthly meetings. When COVID subsists and things are open again, we will be having monthly meetings at 21st South State Street in the conference room once again. Until then, you're welcome to join us on the fourth Friday of each month by Zoom for a presentation by someone who's had a near-death experience. And we invite you also to consider sending the link to this meeting to anyone who might be interested, especially those who are far away and wouldn't otherwise ordinarily be able to attend our meetings. This is a chance for other people who might not often be able to attend or maybe never be able to attend a UTIANS meeting to join. You could send the link absolutely anywhere and they can join. So there are some benefits to Zoom as well as some downsides to it. Tonight, a couple of housekeeping items about future meetings that we have coming up. We have some exciting presentations that are on the horizon. We have a woman from Israel who will be joining us via Zoom from Israel to tell us her near-death experience. She's fairly fluent in English and has a fascinating experience to share. We also have an experiencer who's from Utah, who Arvin Gibson, one of the co-founders, and I have known since the early 1990s, but she has not shared her experience at Utah IONS before. So that and several others, I think, will be really, really fun. For those of you who are looking forward to finding out what is going to be going on here in the future at Utah Ions. I wanted to also mention that our meetings on Zoom and when they're in person are always free and open to the public. A little bit about Ions, where it comes from, what it means, and then I'll be turning the time over to Craig Miller to introduce our guest. ION stands for the International Association for Near-Death Studies, and IONS was originally founded in 1981. The headquarters are currently in Durham, North Carolina. There are over 50 local chapters. Our group, IONS of Utah, was formed in 1990 and is, I believe, the largest local IONS chapter, although we have some disagreement about that from Seattle IONS, which is also quite large. We meet the fourth Friday of each month. Even if there are five Fridays, it's the fourth Friday, not the last one. We're a nonprofit organization. No one on our board is compensated at all. And we are working hard for some great speakers for the future. So please, please join us for all of our future meetings. Now, Craig, do we have you're still working on that? Okay. A couple of other comments about items in the future. Salt Lake is scheduled for the International Convention, the International IONS Convention in 2020, but that was something that did not happen because of coronavirus. We have rescheduled for 2022. There's still some questions about how 2021 will work out. It's the 40th anniversary of IONS, and so this year's will be in Virginia. Next year, we're looking forward to an annual conference here in Salt Lake City, Utah, which will be, I think, really, really fun to do. One of the other points to mention here before we start is that near-death experiences are very, very unique. And don't be troubled if you hear somebody say in their near-death experience something that's different from your own personal belief. That may not necessarily be that your beliefs are wrong or that the person describing them is not telling the truth. It may very well be that what's going on is that somebody has a different way of describing the same thing. We all filter our experiences through our own personal life's experience, and so we describe things in very different ways. To use a political analogy, you can have the same events and people from different political parties or no party at all might see things in very, very different ways, but they're seeing the same event. Similarly, people who have near-death experiences see them in very different ways just because of their own background and the way they interpret those particular experiences. Some other speakers that we have on the horizon that are coming up in the future. One is that Erica McKenzie, who has spoken to us in the past, has also agreed to be a speaker in the future. I think that will be exciting. We also have some speakers who are a little bit more, shall we say, coming from a scientific point of view. We are in the process of lining up some speakers who have scientific and medical backgrounds, which makes the particular experience that they have to share, I think, quite exciting, and that will be fun. New people are entering our waiting room to join this Zoom experience on an ongoing basis. So what I'm going to do is mention one other thing that I already mentioned earlier, and that is that you should feel free to send the link to these meetings to other people each month. We would enjoy having people, especially those who aren't always able to attend. Our speaker tonight is, I think, going to be really exciting. We've had a couple of technical issues with him, and we're trying to sort those out. So hang in there. Usually we would be done with the introductions by now, but I think you'll really enjoy him. I'm going to let Craig do the specific description about our guest for tonight. One of the things that I wanted to also do is talk to everybody for just a minute about where Utah Ions came from. Years ago, in the late 1980s, one of the things that happened is that I was doing a radio show with a bunch of different people who had had near-death experiences. And those people all were fascinating. And I had some guests on. Among those were Arvin Gibson, who was an author. And he, along with Lynn Johnson, who is a PhD psychologist, all three of us came up with the idea of having a meeting and inviting people to it from the Utah area who had near-death experiences. And so we did that. And it was quite a success. We had it at the Hilton Hotel. And all of the people who attended, we asked for people who could have interest in monthly meetings to share near-death experiences and to hear them. And so the vote was very, very positive, and we started doing that. So our Utah Ions group started in the late 1980s, and we were officially a 501c3 nonprofit corporation in 1990 or 91, as I recall, and the rest is history. We started off in the small lunchroom cafeteria, which was at Cottonwood Hospital, which is now Tosh, and we had a number of other people who were part of the organization and who spoke. We from there grew and were in different venues until we got to the location that we are currently at today. Let me check and see if how we're doing with Craig. Bear with me for a minute and see if we're any closer to getting things resolved here. Just a sec.
So hi, Ron. Yeah, he's on. We've just asked him to go unmute, I guess.
Okay, perfect. Great. All right. Looks like we have our guest on, and we're seeing if we can get him unmuted so we can actually hear what he what he has to say. I think you'll be fascinated with this. I first learned about our speaker tonight, Ron Kennedy, many years ago, and was very fascinated with his story, which I'm sure will be fascinating for you as well. It's actually quite unique, and I think it will be something that's well worth your while.
Well, Dr. Kennedy has been having computer problems, and he's on the he called us on the phone, and I don't know what's going on over there because I had him on the phone for a while, but because he's not on the phone, I can't tell you what's going on. So he's supposedly phoning in, and I see him up here. I've asked him to unmute. So we'll see what happens. If I get a phone call in a few minutes, you'll know he wasn't successful. I haven't seen anybody with this many problems before. Well, Martin, do you have a shirt pocket NDE that you can tell people that would be inspiring?
Oh, absolutely. I've got many, many that I could share that would be interesting and inspiring. One of the most fascinating ones that enamored me early on, and I think I first met him, and I'm sure many of you have heard his experience before, is the experience of George Ritchie. I first met George Ritchie in the late 1980s when he was speaking at Skyline High School, and his experience inspired me. And Craig, it looks like our speaker's unmuted, so maybe we can hear him. I guess he's still working on that. Okay, and I became friends with Dr. Ritchie, and he wrote a fascinating book for those of you who may not be familiar with it, which is still available now. It's called Return from Tomorrow, and it's probably the very first full near-death experience that was ever published. Dr. Ritchie knew the Raymond Moody, who published Life After Life, which was the first book on near-death experiences, but it was a compilation of a number of near-death experiences, not just one experience. And it's a fabulous fabulous book, and I highly recommend it. It's a fabulous experience. And another near-death experience that is always stuck with me. I hear you, Craig. Are we sorted anything out there?
Okay, so the best I can do, Martin, is okay. I've got him on speakerphone, and okay. if you can hear him speak on the speakerphone, that'll be it. Let's try it. Dr. Okay. Kennedy, can you start talking, and let's see if we can hear you. Dr. Kennedy? Dr. Kennedy.
Yeah, I'm back. I said I would get a glass of water. Here I am.
Okay, can you hear that, Martin?
Yeah, let's do it.
Well,
it's faint, but you could.
Let me turn off my headphones then, and get something else going.
Okay.
Can you hear me still?
I hear you.
You hear me? Let me see. Audio. Sound.
And I see you on the screen.
Okay. Anyhow, Martin, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, Ron, why don't you give it a try?
You know, when Marconi invented the radio, I imagine it sounded like this. 30 minutes of, can you hear me? And you're like, no, I don't hear. Oh, static. Oh, I hear you.
Okay. Well, go ahead. Everybody's listening to you, Doctor.
Okay. All right. Here we go then. I'm sorry to delay all of you. They've asked me to describe the NDE, and I guess I have about 35 minutes here. Is that correct?
Yes, that'd be great.
Sure. That'd be fine.
All right. Just a little background on myself. I was raised as a good Christian boy, and really insisted, my parents insisted that I go to church, and it was like every weekend. I got kind of burned out on that. By the time I went off to college, I stopped that, and I became kind of agnostic. I was agnostic. I sailed along in that condition until my last year in college, when I was preparing for medical school, and the amount of study I had to do was so enormous that I was sleeping about 3 hours per night, day after day, week after week. And I was going to sleep at night, lying in my bunk. It was a metal frame bunk. I had a room to myself, and as an upperclassman at Texas A&M. And as I was so extremely exhausted that I could not sleep, and as I stared at the bunk above me, I suddenly reached up to grasp the metal frame of the bunk above me. And I was going to pull myself out of bed, maybe go to the sink or something. And as I pulled myself up, I thought, wow, I'm really strong. I had no idea I was so strong, because I had been taking the weightlifting course, but I didn't know I was this strong. So I kept pulling and pulling, and I got to the point where my head was where the springs frame of the bunk above me should be, and I just kept going. And I thought, this is not right. And I turned to look at the bed I thought I was coming from, and there I was still lying there. So I was clearly out of body. This was kind of shocking. And I realized something. I just intuitively, I knew that I had no chance of living. I knew my heart had stopped, and I had essentially died. If I didn't get back to that body immediately, I would not ever get back to it. So I willed myself, and I don't know how to tell anyone how to do this, but I willed myself into my body again. My eyes flipped open, and I sat up on the side of the bed. And I thought, wow, that was strange. And I thought to myself, I'll just walk across the room and splash a little water in my face, and maybe that'll be good for me, and I'll be able to sleep. So I stood up, and as I stood up, the room illuminated, and the light was coming from every place in the room, no particular place, but from every place in the room. And it was so bright. It was just enormously bright. And I took a step, and it was dark, black, completely dark, and took another step, and bright again. So it went like that across the room, light, dark, light, dark, light, dark. I managed to get to the sink, and I did splash my face with some water, and the blinking stopped. So I thought, oh, Lord, I've got to get some sleep. And I went back, and I did sleep, and I slept soundly. That was the end of that event. That changed something in me. I knew there was more out there than I had suspected, but I didn't exactly know what. So I cruised from that point and for another 21 years until I was 41 years old. And by that time I had graduated college. I finished medical school. I'd done my residency in psychiatry, and I was even
went a little beyond psychiatry, and I was giving seminars to people on healing relationships with parents. And those that became so popular, along with some books that I had written, that I was invited to many different countries. And the event that I want to tell you about occurred as I was returning from England. But before I had left England, on a Saturday night between the Saturday and Sunday of the seminar, and I have to tell you that as background, you can't get very far with people in fully transforming their relationships of loving and being loved by parents without dealing with higher power. It's just not possible. So I was speaking for God. I had reclaimed my faith. And as I lay there at that night thinking, you know, I've worked so hard for this fellow, and they say he's a friend. And well, how would I address a friend who never shows up? And so I said, okay, that's it. I'm going to demand, and I demanded that God show up. So I made a prayer, and I don't ordinarily pray. I only pray in circumstances where I can't handle my life, and that is really rare. In this particular instance, I felt that I couldn't handle that. So I said, look, God, if you're there, I want two things. I want you to show up. Show me that you're there, number one. I don't know how that looks, but show me. And number two, by the way, went to church a long time, and they told me you're a Trinity. I have no idea how that can happen, that there are three persons in one. But show me that too, I demand it. And so I prayed that prayer in the Savior's name, and went to sleep. And I didn't just go to sleep. I don't remember what happened after I finished. I think I passed out standing up. At any rate, I woke the next morning refreshed and finished out the seminar. Okay. And then hopped on the plane the next morning to come back to California. So I was in Bristol, England, so I'm coming back to California. Now that's a long ride. And my secretary picked me up at the airport. We ran a little errand, and then we came home. Well, in the meantime, I had invited what had been a friend of mine. His name was Bauman. He's a man from Iran. He was on hard times, and he had run out of a place to stay, and it looked like he was going to be homeless. So I said, look, live at my house while I'm gone. Take care of it. He said, good, thank you. I'll do that. And as we pulled into the driveway, opened the door from the garage to the rest of the house. So one of these three-story homes that go kind of up in San Francisco. So we came through the door from the garage into the foyer, and there is sitting Bauman on the steps. And Bauman was a 29-year-old man, a very athletic person. He had been a member of the Iranian international, you know, the soccer team for Iran. So he was some athlete of note. And as I walked in, I noticed that he was sweating across the brow, and he looked really disturbed. And I went to him and I said, Bauman, are you okay? And I reached to touch his brow, and at that moment, he screamed. He screamed, that's it. And I mean, really, wow. It was earth shaking type of screaming. And I hadn't noticed, but he was holding a steel tennis racket, which he then proceeded to hit me across the left side of my head. I mean, like really hard. And it kind of stunned me, but it didn't knock me out. And I turned back toward him and I said, Bauman, what are you doing? And, well, he showed me what he was doing because he hit me again, also very hard. That turned me to my right just a bit. And I came back at him. I said, Bauman, what are you doing? I'm your friend. I love you. What are you doing? And I was matching his volume of speech by that time. And so he hit me again, third time. And that spun me around toward the door I had just come through. And I was thinking to myself, well, okay, this is not turning out so well. Maybe I should just leave. And so I'm standing there fumbling around with the doorknob, trying to figure out how a doorknob worked, because I think my brain was not exactly tuned up by that time. And I was trying to pull the doorknob rather than turn it. And I guess he must have hit me an extremely hard blow at that point, because the next thing I woke up on the floor. Well, not knowing exactly where I was or what was happening, I pulled myself up to standing position, and I found myself holding him by his shoulders. And he and I are about the same height and weight. So I have one shoulder in one hand, the other shoulder in the other, and I'm talking to him, and I'm asking him, why are you doing this? And the only thing I could think of, I think at that point, was, okay, here's a person who is doing me some serious damage. He's why is he doing this? And the next thing I noticed was he was swinging something at me, and as I looked over his shoulder, I could see blood splattered all over the wall. So he had apparently been carving me up before I came to full consciousness. And in that moment, the only thing I could think of was, oh my God, Bauman is ruining his life. He will spend his life in prison for this. I couldn't manage to think of myself, but I thought of him, and I screamed at him, Bauman, don't kill a man. But he just kept swinging, and he was kind of winding up for what felt like he intended to finish me off with the next blow. So I folded my left arm over my heart. So I thought, well, if he's going to kill me, he's at least not going to hit my heart. He's going to go through my arm. And so he swung the knife and looped it around behind me. We were facing each other, and he looped it around behind me and ripped up the middle of my back. Well, that was the 14th stab of the knife, as it turned out. I learned that from the surgeons later. And as he was as the knife was coming forward, I don't know. I've always told people time stop, but whatever happened, it all happened in such a flash that it probably happened because time stopped. I looked over his left shoulder, and over his left shoulder, appeared to me a hallway. And the hallway was completely white. It was made of, I would say, white light, if you can imagine that. And it extended itself far, far, far into the distance. I don't want to say infinity, but I couldn't see the end of it. So, and then immediately where the hallway had been, or perhaps coming through the hallway, was a triangular light, and this was not the ordinary light, folks. This is the light that people talk about, but it was in a triangular form, like a Christmas tree, a standing up Christmas tree with rounded corners. And there was so clearly someone in the light, and the dominant feeling that came out of the light was well, I mean, you heard it before, but it was love. And it was such an enormous amount of love that it just stunned me. if you can imagine that human love is something like maybe you go to the beach and you're out in the waves a little bit, the waves are going up and down. Well, okay, that's kind of like human love. But if you can imagine the 200-meter tsunami coming behind you, behind all that, then that would be the love of this light. And so I could feel the quality of this light was this enormous love, but it had more qualities that were obvious. All this happened in a flash. I don't even know how that's possible, but I could feel the knowledge, the complete understanding knowledge of everything, and the power, enormous power and authority, but a kind authority, a friendly authority, but an absolute authority. The other quality was humor. It was like you know how you feel when you've heard the funniest joke of your life, but you don't remember the joke, you're just feeling the humor. It was an enormous space of tremendous humor. And so this being in the light, this person in the light, didn't have a lot to say. He said one powerful thing, and said it, by the way, telepathically, not with words. Anyone in any language would have understood this, but it was a question. And the question was, will you come now or later? And I realized that, well, I'm being given a choice here. And I thought about, should I go now or later? And I remembered that I had a 3-year-old son who really loved me and who I really loved, and he needed me. And I also thought of the work that I was doing was, in a way, meaningful, in a very special way. And so, by the way, it's extremely rewarding to reconnect parents and children who have become estranged to each other. And that was the work I had in life at that time. And I knew that that had meaning, and I wanted to finish it. And so I came up with an answer, not a lot of words. It was just later, and the later came as a telepathic thought. The instant I came up with later, the light vanished, the long hallway vanished. The knife completed its arc around my body and up into the middle of my back. Did not penetrate the rib cage, fortunately. It just ripped up through the middle of my back. And as at that moment, I could hear a sound coming from the floor, and it was clink, clink. And I looked down. It was like two big coins had hit the floor, and I looked down. And there was the handle of the knife, and there was the blade of the knife, and they were both on the floor. And so I knew that the knife was essentially neutered at that point, and I knew that the lethality of this attack was over, that I had survived that far, that I would probably survive the rest. And I was so overcome with joy, not the joy that I had been saved from death, but it was the joy of the love and the light that lit me up so in such an ecstasy that I looked at my attacker, and I began to laugh as hard, really as hard as I ever laughed, and I pushed him back into the wall. And well, I forgot that he was still holding he still had this steel tennis racket, so he went to work on me with the tennis racket. And so that's the scuffle continued a little bit, and then just about that time the police showed up, because Paige, who my secretary I mentioned, had brought me home from the airport, she heard this whole thing beginning. And she went from house to house in San Francisco. We didn't have cell phones in those days, of course. And banging on doors, looking for somebody home so she could call the police. On the eighth try, she found someone there and who let her use the phone. She called the police and they showed up. Well, they had to break through the window in the foyer to get in, but they did. And they cuffed him and they took him away. And then after that, the ambulance arrived, and I got a free ride to San Francisco General. When I got there, they put me on the gurney. And I'm lying on the gurney, and I called Paige over because I had to tell somebody. I thought, you know, okay, I survived the attack. Maybe I won't survive the surgery. But somebody has to know. And I called Paige over, and I said, Paige, I saw God. She looked at me rather funny, and I said, it was a light, enormous light full of love. And then they came and took me away because they'd already started an IV and got some fluids in me. I had lost one half of my blood volume in this ordeal, and got to the exam room. The operating room. And there were five surgeons waiting there for me, four males and one female, all doctors, and they were ready to go work on me because they had, more work than one surgeon could do. And so they began to give me the anesthesia. And as they did, I thanked them for being there. And I think I introduced myself, asked them their names, and as the anesthesia took effect, it paralyzed me. I could not speak, I could not move, and yet I could hear everything, and my visual, I could see everything. And so this went on as they began to repair me. I could hear their conversation about this and that and the next thing, and for about 15 minutes. As they sewed me up and repaired me, I could feel what would ordinarily be pain of the procedure, but it wasn't pain, it was only sensation. And it was kind of interesting sensation, so it didn't bother me. And then I went out. And the next thing I knew, I was waking up in the recovery room, I guess 2.5 hours later, something like that. And Paige was there, and my former wife had been alerted, and she was there. And now, that it might be of interest to you how that affected my life. And I hear a lot of people with near-death experiences, they become better people. Well, this did not make me into a saint. In fact, I went on with my life being a fallible human being, the fallible, and I'll say sinful human being that I am. And I was in no friendly mood toward my attacker at that point in time. I was back to regular existence, I'd say, kind of like a rat trying to survive. and so I recovered over a period of about 2 weeks, and my attacker was, of course, taken to jail, and we had two court procedures, and he went off to think about it for 12 years. And then was shipped back to Iran, and that's the last I heard of him. So after that, it was a 1 year later that I felt comfortable enough to share that in the seminars. But I was surprised to note that people in the seminars took it in and made value out of it, a lot of value, really. And not only that, about every eighth or tenth person had had a transcendental experience. So, and I would invite people to share, and I got a lot of really interesting stories out of that. I could entertain you all night with the things that people shared with me and taught me. That's essentially it. I think I've covered the high points of this thing. I have not had any further transcendental experiences since then. I think maybe I needed to have such a thing. I certainly asked for it, didn't I? I prayed for it. Because part of my prayer back in Bristol before all this happened was I made a deal with God. And I thought to myself, okay, God, if God is a friend, then God will make a deal. Just going on my usual human experience of human beings and friendships. And the deal I offered was, show me yourself, and I will accept any consequences. I will accept death itself. If I have to die to see you, then I will die to see you. And that was it. And that's exactly what happened. I did not count on getting a choice to die or not. I thought God would probably make that choice for me. But that's not how it turned out. Okay. I think I'm finished.
Well, thank
you. I don't know how this goes. Do people ask questions or what? How does that go?
Sure, yes. If you have questions, please ask them through the chat window. Martin, do you want to handle this, or would you prefer that I do this?
It doesn't matter. If your hands are full with the recording, I can ask questions as people send them into the chat room.
Okay, we've got a couple already.
Okay.
At least one.
First question. What is the number one thing, the most important takeaway of your experience that you would like to share with everyone here?
Well, I think I got that. It was hard to understand you. If you could speak a little louder, that would help.
Okay.
The number one takeaway?
Yes. What's the number one thing that you learn from your experience that you would like everyone here to understand?
Well, there's a better life to come. I'm very convinced of that. I'm convinced that the essential nature of God is love, and I tried to say this. Everyone says it, but God is love, and God loves you. And you could take that to the bank, as they say, regardless of anything else. God loves you.
Wonderful. Next question. Did you ever find out, or do you have any idea why your friend stabbed you? Why did he do this?
Yeah, good question. He had psychiatric examinations after that, of course, part of his legal defense. But it turns out that according to him, he was believing he had developed what was surely a delusion that I had kidnapped his ex-wife and his daughter and killed them, which would explain his rage. Precisely, but when this was supposed to have happened, I was in England.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Next question. How did your experience impact your work of uniting parents and children?
Well, it empowered it. It gave it a lot of power in the sense, not my power, but God's power. Because people hearing this story can, I don't want to say everyone, but it really should be everyone who can feel God's love in the reality of what happened to me, or what I asked for, actually. I don't want to say it like I was a victim of it, because I wasn't. But it's a, you know, if you work with people to clear up their barriers in life, I don't know how you can do it without introducing the fact that there is God and there is this enormous love, and that this is not all there is. And, you know, prepare yourself as best you can for the next life, because there is one, and it's not short. It's rather long. I think from what I have gathered from other people who have had deeper, you might say deeper experiences, that there is a kind of paradise that folks, if you're prepared for it, if you're prepared for it, you go to that paradise. And there you might say you live, you exist, until, and this is my belief, and it's Christian belief, but that you exist there until, and I don't pretend to know what the final judgment will actually look like, but until some event in which souls are finally evaluated to be there or some, or someplace else.
Fabulous. Next question. Did you see anyone else or anything else while you were having your glimpse of heaven?
No, I didn't see anyone else. But here is something interesting that my mother did. When I was in medical school, she and I were hanging out on the beach talking in Galveston. That's where the med school is located. She told me for the first time about her first husband, who was apparently the love of her life. They married when they were 19, and he passed away when he was 26 from tuberculosis. She said that he came to visit her every night at bedtime, and he would sit on the side of the bed and talk to her, and that when he left, she looked at me and she said, "You know, Ronnie, when he left, there would be an indentation on the side of the bed where he had been sitting," and that went on for a solid year.
Wow.
And I didn't know my mother in those days, but in the days that I did, because I wasn't born yet. But in the days that I did know her, you couldn't describe a saint without thinking of her, her kindness and tolerance and devotion, unlike anything I've ever seen in anyone else. And I didn't know Mother Teresa, but in my ordinary life, I never saw the equal of that. But she had that experience. She definitely saw someone who had already passed away, and she saw, not in a near-death experience, but in regular, actual, real life. Now, since then, I have encountered a person who, for years and years, has seen demons. And she describes them, and she's a very sane person, but she sees demons. And I know there are a few people around who see these things. I have never seen such a thing. And by the way, I hope I never do.
Okay, next question.
Yes.
Did you have a sense for how close or far away heaven is, or was distance kind of muddled the same way time was muddled or different?
Well, interesting you should ask that. How close it is. As I looked down that hallway that seemed to stretch out so far, I couldn't see the end of it. I thought, well, heaven is at the end of that hallway. If you want to know where it is, that's where it is. It's a hallway made of solid light, at least what I saw. And there you find God. And you find your family, if I'm properly informed by other people who have been there.
Next question.
I've heard others speak of it as a planet, as it is actually a planet. I don't know how to deal with that. I presume it's in another dimension. I have a lot of ideas about how that can be explained. But I won't go into that. That's another subject.
Right, and not directly part of your experience. Next question was two different people asked this, so I'm going to sort of merge these together. Did anything in your experience help you answer your question about triune God or trilogy question, or is that still kind of unanswered for you?
My question is, how can the three of you be one? And so when the light showed up, if you'll remember, it showed up as in a triangular shape. I took that as a symbolic way of saying, yeah, we're here and we are one. And yet we have three aspects.
Great and succinct answer. Next question is... And I guess we have somebody who's asking kind of a skeptical question here. How would you answer someone who might question whether your story was really real and not something from your own mind about heaven and the God part of your story? Obviously, you were stabbed, but the rest of it and the link with heaven and God.
Yeah, why was that not a hallucination? That's a good question, and my answer is twofold. Number one, it wasn't. I have seen hallucinations. Bear in mind that I'm in California, and I lived through the 70s and the 80s, and. There's this little chemical called LSD, and I tried it a few times, so I know what hallucination is. This is a totally different thing, and like they all say, and I'll say it myself, it's more real than reality is. It makes this reality seem like made of paper mache or something, but... The short answer, and really the only answers I can give, is why was it not a hallucination? Because I say so.
Because you've experienced hallucination in reality, and you know this is reality and not the other.
Yeah, this is another deal here.
Okay. We're at the end of our hour here, and we'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. If you have any other parting thoughts, we'd invite you to share them, and then we'll wrap up our meeting, Dr. Kennedy, and thank you.
I mean, as a Christian man, I can't do better than just tell you, look, love God and love your neighbor as yourself. live your best life, and have no fear. The end.
I'm sure everyone would applaud, but on Zoom that doesn't work out so well. But we thank you so much for sharing your experience. There are not too many near-death experiences that have someone who was actually in the throes of being murdered when they had their experience. And yet, for those who find themselves or have heard of loved ones being in very, very difficult circumstances, I hope your story of your experience will help them have some comfort and peace that the difficult part is very short in comparison to eternity.
Here's what I believe, that no one dies alone. Now, who you die in the presence of, maybe that has something to do with how you lived your life. I'm not sure. But I believe that no one dies alone, and that no one actually dies. You simply move on. Here's an interesting, and I'll just drop this last story on you. In my seminars in England, I began to speak these things, and someone stood up and said, well, let me tell you about an experience my wife and I had. We were driving on a mountain road and unfortunately drove right off the side of the road. And as our car was falling down, it was turning, and it did a complete 360-degree turn. And it hit the side of the mountain in such a way that we were spared. We were injured, but we lived through it. And in the process of falling down, the light appeared in all its glory. And at the bottom, he said, I said to my wife, I looked at her and I said, did you see that? She said, yes, you saw it too. So it's out there waiting for you, folks.
Beautiful story.
You're welcome, Matt.
Thank you so much. Craig, I'll turn the time back over to you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to end the meeting now. In a few days, you should be able to hear the recording on our website. Probably with some of the anxious conversation about technical difficulties all taken out. So have a great weekend, and we hope to meet you next month.
Thank you for joining us. Good night.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being there.